Hi, I'm Simon Smart from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Series. In this episode, you'll hear William Kavanagh's 2016 lecture titled The Myth of Religious Violence. It's a widely held assumption in Western societies that religion has a peculiar tendency to promote violence. Indeed, much of our domestic and foreign policy assumes this. But is it a fair assumption? Are religions more inclined to promote violence than things like nationalism or access to oil? What even counts as religion? And what role have secular ideologies, as well as religious ones, played in fomenting violence? American philosopher William Kavanagh offers some provocative arguments.
Thanks, Simon, for that kind introduction, and thanks to everybody at the center for your hospitality and the good work that you do here. I'm really filled with admiration for the work that you do. It's really important, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that documentary when it comes out next year, and not just because I'm in it, but I think it'll be really great. I'm really delighted to be here in Australia for the second time. I love Australia, and I love Australians. Richard said at dinner that Australians don't take themselves too seriously, which I think is a real virtue. And I was just wondering if I could maybe stay here for a while my country gets a little less crazy. So I was out for a walk not too long ago, and I came across a very distraught man who was standing on a bridge and was threatening to throw himself off the bridge. And I said, wait, don't do it. There's so much to live for. Do you believe in God? And he said, yes. And I said, me too. Are you a Christian or a Jew? And he said, I'm a Christian. And I said, me too. Protestant or Catholic? And he said, Protestant. And I said, me too. What kind? And he said, I'm a Baptist. And I said, me too. Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist? And he said, Northern Baptist. And I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist? And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist. And I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist New England region? And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region. And I said, me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912? And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912. And I said, die, heretic! And I pushed him off the bridge. Not a true story. That is a joke by the comedian Emo Phillips, and it was voted the funniest religion joke in an online poll a few years ago. And it's hard to argue with that, but it tells us something about the way that people think about religion, right? It has this inherent tendency to be divisive and so on. When I gave a lecture with the title, Does Religion Cause Violence, at a university a couple of years ago, I was on my way to the lecture hall and I saw a poster advertising the lecture, and someone had written the word duh across the poster. And I think that kind of tells us a lot about the way people think about these matters, right? I mean, clearly there's lots of examples of religion has a dangerous tendency to promote violence and so on. Some people try to deny this and say that the violence is really political and not religious or something like that. But I think such arguments don't really work, right? They're refuted by the terrorists' own words. They also assume a clear distinction between the religious and the political, which is something that I'm going to try to kind of undo this evening. And I don't think it works either to say that, well, crusaders are not really Christians because they didn't understand Christ, or ISIS is not really Muslims, and so on. I think it's normatively important to claim that the crusaders were not really, they didn't really understand the message of Jesus Christ. And I think normatively it's important for Muslims to say that, no, ISIS, they don't understand Islam. But descriptively, I think you have to say, yes, the crusaders were Christians, and yes, ISIS are Muslims. And we can't just kind of wash our hands of them quite so easily. We have to do penance collectively for our own collective historical sins, I think. So those are some arguments that I think don't work. Now, the idea that religion, though, promotes violence is part of the conventional wisdom of Western societies. And it affects our domestic policies for kind of keeping religion out of the public sphere. It affects foreign policies, using military power to try to project secularism in other parts of the world and so on. And I think this mention of military power for liberal politics indicates that people kill for other things besides religion, right? That seems undeniable and obvious too. Behind the common tale of religion and violence, therefore, there has to be a stronger claim, right? So I'm not denying that people kill on behalf of Christianity, Islam, etc. I think they kill for other things as well. The claim behind what I call the myth of religious violence, though, is stronger. It's a claim that religion has a greater tendency to promote violence than what is not religion, what would be the secular, right? So the idea that religion promotes violence depends entirely on this distinction between the religious and the secular, right? So the argument is that religion causes more violence than the secular, so you have to have a very sharp distinction between the religious and the secular. So what I call the myth of religious violence goes like this, that religion is this trans-historical, trans-cultural, meaning found in all times and all places, human impulse that is essentially distinct from secular ideologies and institutions. Secondly, religion is more prone to promote violence than secular ideologies and institutions. And thirdly, therefore, religion should be marginalized from public power and we should fight to defend and spread secular ideals. So again, this myth of religious violence depends on this sharp distinction as in this table, right? In the religious column, there is Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, etc., a few other world religions. And in the secular column, we find non-religious categories of human life, such as politics and economics, as well as ideologies and practices like nationalism, atheism, Marxism, capitalism, liberalism, and so on. So the common notion that religion is peculiarly prone to violence depends on the idea that these secular matters have less of a tendency to promote violence, and it's commonly assumed that this is because they have to do with merely mundane affairs, whereas religion, on the other hand, is seen as peculiarly incendiary because it raises the stakes to another level where reason is trumped by passion. And so in the academic literature about religion and violence, religion is commonly assumed to be peculiarly absolutist and divisive and irrational. Now, if we cast a glance over the extraordinarily bloody last 100 years or so, complicating evidence presses itself upon us. So World War I, for example, to which nationalism is generally assigned as a primary cause, resulted in 38 million military and civilian casualties. It's hard to blame that one on religion. Deaths under Marxist regimes are estimated in figures that range as high as 110 million. That's always a conversation starter to ask, who's killed more people in the last 100 years, Muslims or atheists? And the answer is atheists, and it's not even close. The death toll under the three regimes alone of Stalin, Mao, and the Khmer Rouge ranges from a low estimate of 21 million to a high of 70 million, and all were militantly atheist. So the last 100 years have seen frequent war waged for oil and land and flags and free markets and democracy and ethnicity and a host of other secular causes. So what becomes of the idea that religion has a peculiar tendency to promote violence in the face of this evidence? Well, one way of dealing with this evidence is simple. You just move the offending ideologies over to the other side of the table. And this is what atheist Christopher Hitchens does in his book to which Simon referred. The book is called God is Not Great, and it's subtitled with typical British understatement, How Religion Poisons Everything. And he says that totalitarianism aims at human perfection, which is essentially a religious impulse, and therefore everything that Marxism and so on counts as religion. Religion, in other words, poisons everything because everything poisonous gets identified as religion. So, and at the same time, everything good ends up on the other side. So Hitchens says of Martin Luther King, in no real as opposed to nominal sense, was he a Christian? And he bases this remarkable conclusion on the fact that Martin Luther King was nonviolent, and so he couldn't possibly be religious because he was because religion is defined as violent, right? So the Hitchens' scheme looks something like this, right? The religious secular distinction is basically nothing more than a distinction between things that Hitchens likes and things that Hitchens doesn't like. And Hitchens is not alone in this at all. Once we start examining arguments that religion causes violence, we find that this sort of smoke and mirrors is really the norm. So the argument that religion has a peculiar disposition toward violence depends, again, on this sharp dividing line. But things are constantly being smuggled back and forth across the line in the literature. And let me give you a few examples of this. Political theorist Bhikkhu Parekh, for example, issues this blistering indictment of religion. It arouses powerful and sometimes irrational impulses and can easily destabilize society, cause political havoc, and create a veritable hell on earth. He goes on to confess, however, that, quote, several secular ideologies, such as some varieties of Marxism, conservatism, even liberalism, have a quasi-religious orientation and form, and conversely, formally religious languages sometimes have a secular content, so the dividing line between the secular and a religious language is sometimes difficult to draw. So violent and irrational impulses are popping up everywhere, even in liberalism, which inspires the creation of this category quasi-religious to try to corral them all back onto religion's side. Another example, the preeminent historian of religion, Martin Marty. In a book on public religion, Marty argues that religion has a particular tendency to be divisive and therefore violent. But Marty lists 17 different definitions of religion, and then he says, well, we can't really give a definition of religion, so I'm going to give you five features that mark a religion. And he gives a list of these five features, and then he proceeds to show how politics displays all five of the same features. So religion focuses our ultimate concern, and so does politics. Religion builds community, and so does politics, and on down the list. So he's trying to show how closely intertwined religion and politics are, but he ends up demolishing any theoretical basis for separating the two. So it's not clear what becomes of the religious-secular distinction here. Another example, sociologist Mark Juergensmeyer, whose book Terror in the Mind of God is one of the most widely read academic books on the subject. And according to Juergensmeyer, religion exacerbates the tendency to divide people into friends and enemies, good and evil, us and them, by ratcheting divisions up to a cosmic level. But he is forced at some point to admit the difficulty of separating religious violence from secular violence. And he writes, secular nationalism, like religion, embraces what one scholar calls a doctrine of destiny. We can take this further and state flatly that secular nationalism is a religion. And this is an important concession, as is his claim that the secular is a sort of advanced form of religion. If true, though, it subverts the entire basis of his argument. What becomes of the religious-secular divide if the secular is a form of religion, right? So some religion and violence theorists deal with this problem by openly and consistently expanding the category of religion to include things that we usually consider to be secular. So Richard Wentz's book, Why People Do Bad Things in the Name of Religion, includes not only Islam and Christianity and Buddhism and so on, but also consumerism, secular humanism, football fanaticism, faith in technology, and a bunch of other things are included under the rubric of religion. And so he concludes, perhaps all of us do bad things in the name of religion, which is kind of a remarkable conclusion to the book called Why People Do Bad Things in the Name of Religion. He has intuited correctly, I think, that people do violence for all sorts of reasons. Where he goes wrong is in thinking that he can obliterate the line between the religious and the secular and still end up blaming violence on religion, right? Religion as opposed to what is not clear. So instead of an argument for why religion has a greater tendency than the secular to promote violence, Wentz has simply taken everything for which people do violence and labeled it religion, right? So Wentz is often called a functionalist, that is, a scholar who believes that religion is whatever functions like one. And there's a vast literature that does the same sort of thing. There's a vast literature on Marxism as religion, for example. And if you take a look at these two images side by side, you can kind of see why, right? Our Lady of Mount Carmel and Joe Stalin. I just love doing this. There's an extensive body of literature as well that explores the prevalence of civil religion in many countries, including the United States. Robert Bellis says, a civil religion in the United States has its own seriousness and integrity and requires the same care and understanding that any other religion does. Carolyn Marvin similarly argues that, quote, nationalism is the most powerful religion in the United States and perhaps in many other countries. Nationalism is the most powerful religion in the United States, Marvin argues. And there's all kinds of evidence for this, especially in rituals surrounding the flag. This is the way that American school children used to salute the American flag before Hitler made this gesture unpopular in the 1930s. And now it's a hand over heart. This was actually the image that I asked Oxford University Press to put on the front cover of the book, and they thought this was a little bit too incendiary, so they opted for something else. More images. This is not Nuremberg. This is, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, or something like that. I thought you might miss him, so I put him in there. Lots of different examples of civil religion. This is the image that you see if you walk into the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. and look up at the ceiling. It's a painting done in the 19th century called The Apotheosis of Washington, The Becoming God of Washington. And it's an image of George Washington ascending into the heavens surrounded by these mythological figures. The examples can go on and on. California had rolling blackouts a few years ago, and the architect of the deregulation of the electricity industry was a believer in free markets, and he was quoted in the New York Times as saying that free markets always work better than state control, and he said, I believe in that premise as a matter of religious faith. And scholars who take a functionalist approach will kind of take him at his word, right? If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck, right? If it acts like a religion, it's a religion. And a survey of religious studies literature finds all sorts of things treated under the rubric religion. For example, totems, witchcraft, human rights, Marxism, liberalism, Freudianism, Japanese tea ceremonies, nationalism, sports fanaticism, free market ideology, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the list goes on and on. Okay, now at this point, you might be thinking, okay, all of those people are just wrong, right? We know what religion is. What religion really means is belief in a god or gods. So if you go back to that first slide, it's clear enough, right? We all know what religion is and what secular is. Some people get confused, but we all really know what it is. But if you look at this list, you'll notice that some of the things that are usually called religions, such as Taoism and Confucianism and some forms of Buddhism, don't have a central concept of God or gods. So you might say, okay, well, let's just expand the definition of religion to include those things under the rubric of maybe transcendence or something more inclusive than God or gods. But if we do that, then all sorts of practices, including many that are usually labeled secular, begin to fall into the category of religion. So many institutions and ideologies that don't explicitly refer to God or gods function in the same way that those that do. So expanding the definition of religion to include godless Buddhism makes it very difficult to exclude godless communism, for example. And it's hard to imagine a better candidate for transcendence than nationalism. The term transcendence, in fact, is a tool of Western scholars of religion who borrowed the term from the Judeo-Christian tradition with this idea of a creator God who transcends creation, but there's no such thing in Buddhism. So to apply that term to Buddhism then requires that you just make it vague. Right, but the vaguer that you make it, then all kinds of things begin to fall into this category of religion, such as nationalism. And that applies to terms like transcendence, the sacred, the super-empirical, and so on. Now, even if we could find a way to stabilize the categories of religious and secular and got everybody to agree what belongs in each category once and for all, would it be any help with the question of violence? And there I think we need to ask, is there any good reason to suppose that people are more likely to kill for a god than for a nation, for example, right? If we ask what percentage of Americans who identify themselves as Christians would be willing to kill for Jesus and what percentage would be willing to kill for the nation, it's quite clear that the nation state is subject to far more absolutist fervor than Christianity. For the majority of American Christians, I suspect this is true in Australia as well, even to talk about God in public is considered to be sort of in bad taste. But we assume, at least in America, that killing on behalf of the nation is often necessary and laudable. I think we need to conclude then that there is no coherent way to isolate religious ideologies with a peculiar tendency toward violence from their tamer secular counterparts, so-called secular ideologies and institutions like nationalism and capitalism can inspire just as much violence as so-called religion. And if all of that sounds like academic hair-splitting over definitions, it's really nothing more complicated than what the Bible says about idolatry. People treat all kinds of things as gods, right? Golden calves and armies and mammon, as Jesus says, even their own bellies, as Paul tells the Philippians, right? And the Bible, of course, teaches that there is one true God among many false gods, but the Bible doesn't think there is one set of religious pursuits and another essentially different set of mundane and secular pursuits. So people in actual fact treat all kinds of things as if they were gods, and so-called religious and so-called secular ideas and practices often function in the same way. It's just, I think, a very basic biblical insight, and that's why the first commandment is what it is. So the myth of religious violence fails because it depends entirely on a stable religious-secular divide that doesn't exist. There is no once-and-for-all definition of religion. Religion is a category constructed in different ways, in different times and places, and according to different interests of who's doing the construction, and that's very obvious in Hitchens' case. To understand why there's so much confusion around the category of religion, I want to go on now to briefly examine the history of this term.
We'll be back to the lecture after a short break.
Today, there are over 40 million people trapped in slavery. That's more than ever before in human history. We are International Justice Mission, and we believe we can end slavery in our lifetime. Together with our local partners, RJM rescues and restores victims, brings criminals to justice, and strengthens justice systems. To find out more, visit rjm.org.au. International Justice Mission. Until all are free.
And now, back to the lecture.
Charles Kimball's book, When Religion Becomes Evil, begins with the following claim. It is somewhat trite, but nevertheless sadly true, to say that more wars have been waged, more people killed, and these days more evil perpetrated in the name of religion than by any other institutional force in human history. Now, he doesn't try to prove this, but if he did try to prove it, you'd have to have transhistorical and transcultural concept of religion, right, all times and all places, that would be at least theoretically separable from other institutional forces over the course of history, so separable from political institutions, for example. Now, the problem is that there was no religion considered as something separable from politics until the modern era, and then primarily in the West. So the Romans had the term religio, but there was no religion-politics distinction, right? How could you have a religion-politics distinction when Caesar is a god? We can ask, are the Aztecs bloody human sacrifices because of their religion or because of their politics? Well, it's a nonsensical question because it's all kind of densely intertwined. As Wilfred Cantwell Smith showed in his landmark 1962 book, The Meaning and End of Religion, religion as a discrete category of human activity separable from culture, politics, economics, etc., is an invention of the modern West. So the ancient Romans employed the term religio, but it covered all kinds of civic duties that we would consider to be secular. So St. Augustine says in The City of God, we have no right to affirm with confidence that religio is confined to the worship of God, since it seems that this word has been detached from its normal meaning, in which it refers to an attitude of respect in relations between a man and his neighbor. Right? That's nothing like what we mean when we talk about religion. In the medieval era, the religious-secular distinction was a distinction between two different kinds of priests. Those priests that belonged to an order, like the Benedictines or the Franciscans, and those priests that belonged to a diocese. Again, that religious-secular distinction doesn't mean anything like what we mean by this. Catholics still sometimes refer to like joining an order as entering the religious life. In the Oxford English Dictionary, if you look in 1400, the religions of England were the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and so on. There was no realm of secular pursuits to which God was indifferent. There was a distinction between civil and ecclesiastical authorities, but there wasn't a distinction between religion and politics as we conceive it. So where did that come about? The religion-politics distinction, or religious-secular distinction, as we know it today, was a product of the early modern struggles for power between ecclesiastical and civil authorities. And here I'm going to telescope a very complicated history and oversimplify it a little bit. If you want to know more about it, I'd go into great detail in the book. In the creation of the modern sovereign state between the 15th and the 17th centuries, religion was basically invented as a universal, essentially interior and private impulse that is essentially separate from politics and other secular concerns. Why? Because then you can take the church's concern and put it over here and say, okay, you go deal with that, and we, the civil authorities, will deal with the public, you know, the political, the economic, and so on. So this religion, politics, religious-secular distinction, which you really don't find until the late 17th century, that is a contingent arrangement of power in early modern Europe, and it's not just the way things are, right? So the religious-secular distinction, once you've got it in Europe, it then gets exported to the rest of the world during the process of colonization. Smith concluded that, quote, there is no closely equivalent concept to religion in any culture that has not been influenced by the modern West, end quote. There was no such concept in ancient Greece, Egypt, India, China, etc. And it's very interesting, in their initial encounters with the non-Western world, the European explorers reported back with remarkable consistency that the natives have no religion at all. It was only once they became colonized that we discovered that they have religions. And why? Why is that? Because the concept is useful. It's really useful. Hinduism, for example, which is a term that you first find in the 1780s. Before that, you've got Hindus, but you don't have Hinduism. It kind of takes in everything it means to be Indian, right? Everything that we would divide into politics and culture and religion and so on. You take everything it is to be Indian and you call it a religion, and then you can marginalize it from public power. So the religious secular distinction then means that to be Indian is to be private and to be British is to be public. And this kind of thing goes on across the world, and I cite many examples of it in my book. Richard Cohen, a modern scholar, says that Hindu nationalists still refuse to refer to Hinduism as a religion precisely because they want to emphasize that Hinduism is more than mere internalized beliefs. It's social, political, economic, familial in nature. And this is repeated over and over in China, in Japan, in parts of Africa where the local people deny that they have religion, and Western scholars say, oh no, yes, you actually do, right? The Chinese government today still excludes Confucianism from its list of official religions in China because it's seen as something which is greater than mere religion, which is private and otherworldly. And so in her book, The Invention of World Religions, Tomoko Masasawa concludes, quote, this concept of religion as a general transcultural phenomenon, yet also as a distinct sphere in its own right, is patently groundless. It came from nowhere, and there is no credible way of demonstrating its factual and empirical substantiality. The only thing about this quote that I would disagree with is the idea that it came from nowhere. It came from a very specific place. It came from Europe and was exported elsewhere. In other words, the religious-secular distinction is not engraved in the nature of things. It's a distinction that's employed in Western or Westernized societies to marginalize certain kinds of beliefs and to authorize others. So, the final part of my comments tonight have to do with the third part of the myth, and that is, what's it used for, right? If the myth of religious violence is so incoherent, why is it so prevalent? Why is it so popular? Why do you hear it from every journalist and politician and jurist and student and person on the street, right? Well, I'm going to look at the first part of this, the domestic marginalization of religious speech, and then talk about the foreign policy implications of this. And my examples are going to be taken from the American context, because that's the context that I know, but I suspect there are very strong analogies with the Australian context as well. So I went back and I read every Supreme Court, every U.S. Supreme Court decision on religion, First Amendment questions, and discovered that until 1940, religion is consistently cited as having a unifying effect in American society, and after 1940, it's cited as having a divisive effect in American society, something potentially dangerous. The first U.S. Supreme Court decision to invoke this myth of religious violence was a decision called Minersville School District versus Gobitis, which dealt with compulsory pledging of allegiance to the American flag. So what was at issue was whether or not you could force Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the American flag. The Jehovah's Witnesses thought that this was idolatrous. And so Justice Felix Frankfurter invokes this specter of religious wars in arguing for his decision. And he says, centuries of strife over the erection of particular dogmas as exclusive or all-comprehending faiths led to the inclusion of a guarantee for religious freedom in the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment sought to guard against repetition of those bitter religious struggles, which he never identifies, by prohibiting the establishment of a state religion and by securing to every sect the free exercise of his faith. Now, you all assume, of course, as I did, that Justice Frankfurter would have ruled then, therefore, that the Jehovah's Witnesses can't be forced to salute the American flag. Well, you would be wrong, right? He actually argues that free exercise does not apply to the Jehovah's Witnesses in this case because their dissent threatened the promotion of national cohesion. We are dealing with an interest inferior to none in the hierarchy of legal values. National unity is the basis of national security. And then he says in a kind of creepy sentence, what the school authorities are really asserting is the right to awaken in the child's mind considerations as to the significance of the flag contrary to those implanted by the parent. And they held that up. Now, the court would reverse itself 3 years later on this. But Frankfurter had succeeded in introducing the idea that First Amendment decisions could be made on the basis of this kind of unspecified history of bitter religious violence. And the antidote to that is national unity, right? Religion is divisive and violent, and so we need to all rally around the flag, right? Now, Martin Marty discusses this case in his book that I talked about before, and he cites many instances of Jehovah's Witnesses who were attacked and beaten and castrated and tarred and feathered and imprisoned and so on in the 1940s, because they believed that followers of Jesus Christ could not salute a flag. And one would think then that he would draw the obvious conclusion that zealous nationalism can cause violence. Wrong again, right? Here's what he says. Astonishingly, he concludes, it became obvious that religion, which can pose us versus them, carries risks and can be perceived by others as dangerous. Religion can cause all kinds of trouble in the public arena. Right? Astonishing. So religion for Marty refers not to the ritual vowing of allegiance to a flag, but only to the Jehovah's Witnesses' refusal to do so, right? So religion causes violence even though it's the Jehovah's Witnesses who are suffering the violence rather than inflicting it. So the myth of religious violence is used to draw attention away from nationalist violence. And in the succeeding decades, then, the myth of religious violence would be invoked by the Supreme Court in case after case after case. When they banned school prayer in the Abington case in 1963, again invoking the myth of religious violence, Justice Potter Stewart dissented, and he warned of, quote, the establishment of a religion of secularism. Interesting phrase, the establishment of a religion of secularism. And he cited the fact that the Supreme Court itself opens its sessions with God Save This Honorable Court and so on. So a couple of his fellow justices replied to this and said, no, patriotic invocations of God are very different from religious invocations of God. They say, there is nothing in the decision reached here that's inconsistent with the fact that school children and others are officially encouraged to express love for our country by reciting historical documents that contain references to the deity and so on. Such patriotic or ceremonial occasions bear no true resemblance to the unquestioned religious exercise that the state has sponsored in this instance, meaning school prayer. They don't give any argument for why that's the case, but it's clear that what separates religion from what's not religion is not the invocation of God. You can invoke God in public ceremonies as long as they're patriotic, right? So separating religious from non-religious speech doesn't depend on the presence or absence of expressions of faith in God, but the presence or absence of expressions of faith in the United States of America. And so American nationalism, again, is the antidote for religious divisiveness. And, you know, it's a short step from there that you get revulsion to killing and dying in the name of religion as kind of support for killing and dying in the name of America, which brings me to foreign policy. And I'll close with that. The conventional wisdom helps reinforce and justify Western attitudes and policies towards the non-Western world, especially these days, of course, Muslims, right? So in post-9/11 discourse, we tell ourselves that we have a peaceful, secular type of state in which religious speech has been tamed. Those crazy people over there, Muslims, they still mix religion with politics, which makes their politics dangerous. So their violence is religious and therefore irrational and divisive. Our violence, on the other hand, is secular and rational and peacemaking. And so, regrettably, we find ourselves forced to bomb them into the higher rationality. So Christopher Hitchens, for example, he skewers religion for its violence, but he was an enthusiastic supporter of the Iraq War. And despite his attempt to recruit Martin Luther King to his side, he has some very approving things to say about violence. He says, and I say to the Christians while I'm at it, go love your own enemies, by the way. Don't be loving mine. I think the enemies of civilization should be beaten and killed and defeated, and I don't make any apology for it. So for Hitchens, the Iraq War was part of a broader war for secularism, and the game was zero sum. So he says, it's not possible for me to say, well, you pursue your Shiite dream of a hidden imam, and I pursue my study of Thomas Paine and George Orwell, and the world is big enough for both of us. The true believer cannot rest until the whole world bows the knee. And of course, what he means is the true believer in Islam, but of course, the hidden message is that the true believer in secularism can't rest until the whole world has been converted to secularism by force if necessary. Fellow new atheist Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith, which is about the violence and irrationality of religion, is full of this kind of double standard, right? He has a part at the beginning where he condemns the irrational religious torture of witches, but then towards the end of the book, he provides his own rationale for torturing terrorists. And his book is charged with this conviction that we can't reason with religious people, so we have to deal with them by force. And so he says, some propositions are so dangerous it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. Certain beliefs place their adherents beyond the reach of every peaceful means of persuasion, while inspiring them to commit acts of extraordinary violence against others. There is, in fact, no talking to some people, people who believe in crazy things like an invisible God. If they cannot be captured, and they often cannot, otherwise tolerant people may be justified in killing them in self-defense. This is what the United States attempted in Afghanistan, etc. And it's what we and other Western powers are bound to attempt at an even greater cost to ourselves and innocents abroad, elsewhere in the Muslim world. We will continue to spill blood in what is, at bottom, a war of ideas. Right? And here's an example of how the myth of religious violence becomes a justification for violence. Right? And the logic is impeccable. There's no use trying to reason with religious people because they're irrational, and so you can only deal with them by force. In a chapter entitled "The Problem with Islam," Harris writes, "In our dialogue with the Muslim world, we are confronted by people who hold beliefs for which there is no rational justification and which therefore cannot even be discussed. And yet these are the very beliefs that underlie many of the demands they are likely to make upon us." And he goes on to say this is especially a problem if such people gain access to nuclear weapons. There is little possibility of our having a cold war with an Islamist regime armed with long-range nuclear weapons. In such a situation, the only thing likely to ensure our survival may be a nuclear first strike of our own. Needless to say, this would be an unthinkable crime as it would kill tens of millions of innocent civilians in a single day, but it may be the only course of action available to us given what Islamists believe. He goes on to say that Muslims would likely misinterpret this act of self-defense as a genocidal crusade. I swear I'm not making this up. Thus plunging the world into nuclear holocaust. And he says all of this is perfectly insane, of course. I've just described a plausible scenario in which much of the world's population could be annihilated on account of religious ideas that belong on the same shelf with Batman, the Philosopher's Stone, and unicorns. So if we have to slaughter millions of Muslims in a nuclear first strike, it's their fault for their crazy beliefs. Before we get to that point, he continues, we have to encourage civil society in Islamic countries, but we can't trust them to vote it in. So one more quote from Harris. It seems all but certain that some form of benign dictatorship will generally be necessary to bridge the gap. But benignity is the key, and if it cannot emerge from within a state, it must be imposed from without. Imposed benignity, that's a good phrase, oxymoron. The means of such imposition are necessarily crude, economic isolation, military intervention, etc. While this may seem an exceedingly arrogant doctrine to espouse, it appears we have no alternatives. Now, Harris's book is a particularly blunt version of this kind of argument, but he is not an isolated figure. This book won the 2005 Penn Award for nonfiction. It was a New York Times bestseller. It has been endorsed enthusiastically by academic superstars like Richard Dawkins and Alan Dershowitz and Peter Singer. Peter Singer, who you may know, is a famed Australian scholar who thinks that you should not kill non-rational animals for food. But apparently non-rational Muslims is a different story. And Harris's logic here really is little different from the common assumption in American foreign policy anyway, that our liberal values are, quote, right and true for every person in every society, and we will take military action if necessary to promote such values. And those were actually quotes from George W. Bush's national security strategy. So here's my argument then in summary, to conclude. I don't wish either to deny the virtues of liberalism or to excuse the vices of other kinds of social orders. Let me be very clear about that. There's a lot of bad people out there, and I like liberal, secular social orders where church and state are separate and so on. And there are crazy places in the world. What I'm trying to do, though, is to level the playing field so that we examine the violence of jihad, for example. But we also examine the violence that can be generated by ideologies of free markets and free elections, right? Let's examine the violence that can be done by a kind of penal substitutionary theory of atonement. Let's also examine the violence that can be done on behalf of the invisible hand of the market. Put very simply, my argument is that people kill for all sorts of things. They kill for gods, they kill for money, they kill for flags, they kill for oil, they kill for freedom. And these are things that function as gods in people's lives. So I want to challenge the religious-secular dichotomy that causes us to turn a blind eye to liberal forms of imperialism and violence, insofar as the myth of religious violence creates the villains against which a liberal social order defines itself. The myth is really little different than previous forms of Western imperialism that established the inferiority of the non-Western others and subjected them to our power in the hopes that we would make them look more like us. Right? That is not something that only happened in Africa in the early 19th century. It continues to go on. They're not like us. We need to make them more like us. So I don't want to either vilify Western-style liberalism nor justify theocracy, but rather help us to see that those are not the only two choices there are. Right? Canada and Iran are not the only two choices. Right? There's lots of other stuff possible in between. So violence, of course, feeds on the need for enemies, the need to separate us from them. And these binary ways of dividing the world make the world understandable for us, but they make the world unlivable for many. The division of the world into religious and secular, believers and non-believers. You're a believer, but I'm a non-believer. I don't believe anything. I just have facts, whereas you're crazy because you're a believer, right? All of these kind of binary ways of dividing up the world, that's what I'm trying to question. So doing away with the myth of religious violence is one way of resisting such binaries and perhaps turning some enemies into friends. Thank you.
You've been listening to the 2016 Richard Johnson Lecture delivered by William Kavanagh. Kavanagh is Professor of Theology at DePaul University in Chicago and has worked for the Center for Civil and Human Rights at the Notre Dame Law School. His areas of specialization include political theology and economic ethics. He's the author of The Myth of Religious Violence and Field Hospital, The Church's Engagement with a Wounded World. Please also check out our other podcast, Life and Faith, which is a weekly conversation about the beauty and complexity of belief in the 21st century. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.